Namaste. Good morning, everyone. Someone asked a question. How do I know that I am doing the right thing? In any situation, how do I know that I am doing the right thing? And what if doing the right thing creates stress? You see, one cannot do a wrong thing in this sense. Because if we do precisely that which we think and feel we should do, based on our genetics and conditioning, which make up our nature. So if we do precisely that which we think and feel we should do in a given situation, knowing that it is truly not our doing, then that, in the sense, is the right thing to do. Knowing also that the results of our action are not in our control. Knowing that all actions will have consequences. Even more so because we live in a society that has rules and regulations. Now, let's take this in the context of doing something we would not normally have done, which is what the questioner is actually asking. Let's say it is not one's nature to do something, but circumstances arise and make one perform an action that one would not normally have performed, and that creates stress. I'll give you an example. You see, when my father passed away, my mother was a housewife, no training in business as such. And my father was running a very successful advertising agency at the time he passed away. Now, suddenly, my mother found herself thrust into the world of business, of which she knew nothing. In fact, my father's friends took my mother to the office and showed her how to sign checks. She didn't even know that. In those days, all payments were made by check. So it was something completely beyond her ability, you could say. There was no conditioning connected with running an office. Now, it so happened that we had a Delhi branch office in New Delhi. And apparently, I was very young at the time. What happened was, when my father passed away, the general manager of the Delhi office put up a notice for the staff saying that the Bombay office branch manager had passed away and claiming that the Delhi office was the head office. Now, they had a very big client who spent a lot of money. And in the advertising industry, the client pays after a credit period of about 60 days. And the agency has to pay the money to the newspaper or the magazines, wherever the ads appeared. In those days, there was no internet. Irrespective of whether the client pays the agency or not. Irrespective. That is why it was such a difficult business to be in. Now, we found that the Delhi general manager had been in cahoots with this client and told the client, don't pay the agency. We will strike a deal between us. Now, my mother didn't know what to do. It's quite unbelievable. People are shocked when those who knew her, know her, are quite shocked when they hear this story. So she was told that going to the courts will not help because you will lose a lot of money hiring lawyers, the case will drag on for years. Please don't go down that road. You don't have that wherewithal to take this battle into the courtrooms. And so somebody proposed to her to go to the local mafia. If you've seen The Godfather, someone like the Marlon Brando figure. She was told only he can get your money out fast if you need to survive. Now, can you imagine a housewife with three young children, 14, 15, 16, not knowing what to do financially, finds herself in this situation, confronted with whether or not to do something not in her nature to do. And she approached the Godfather. She was fearful, of course. She approached the Godfather to try and get money that was rightfully belonging to the agency. So she did what she felt was the right thing to do in the given situation. Now, despite involving the Godfather, the money didn't come. The assurance of the money being paid came, but the money did not come. So, was it the right thing to do? We cannot judge it on the outcome because one never knows the outcome. It is the circumstance that determines the action. In this case, taking into account the entire situation, a decision had to be taken. And one had to be prepared for the consequences of that decision. For example, a friend of my father mentioned to my mother that please don't do this because you don't want to jeopardize your family should the goon who was the client take a countermeasure. Even that was factored in. But my mother was faced with the situation that if the money didn't come, the business would collapse and then whatever income was coming to this family, which was left without the head of the family, even that would go, you see. And In her biography, which was released 2 years ago, this incident is mentioned, where she says, I don't know where the strength came from to take that decision. So sometimes in life, we find that we perform actions that we would not normally perform. We do things that we would not normally do. The circumstance and the situation that is placed before us puts us on the spot, so to speak. So in that sense, it is not our doing. If it is not our doing, there is no question of whether it is the right or wrong thing to do. The question, is it the right thing to do, is directly linked to the investment in the outcome. But if the understanding is there, that no matter what happens, no matter what I do, I have no idea which way this will go. Then this fear, is it right? Is it not right? Is it right? Is it not right? Which is nothing but the thinking mind trying to stabilize with a concept of a certain outcome and therefore wondering, this way or this way, this way or this way. Now for the sage, for the man of understanding, this does not happen. The sage accepts that my nature is a certain way, but sometimes the spontaneity of life may pull up a different response from the body-mind organism of the sage. So the sage is even open to that spontaneity. But the sage is never invested in the outcome of the sage's action, because there is a total knowing that the results are not in my control. So even if discomfort arises for the sage, because what is his natural setting, what comes naturally, appears to be overridden by a different kind of action, one that the sage is not used to, even that will be witnessed by the sage without judgment, knowing that anything can happen the next moment. So there is no question of right or wrong. Rameshji would mention that someone asked Maharaj once, what if a man in your satsang pulls out a gun and points it at you? What will you do? And Maharaj's reply was, I don't know. You see, there's no predetermined course of thinking in the mind of the sage. The sage lives the life spontaneous. He does not know. On a lighter note, I read in one of the books that someone asked Maharaj, what would happen if someone came and chopped your head off? And Maharaj replied, certain lines of communication will get cut. The beauty of this is when we accept that there is really no such thing as right and wrong and all these concepts. We don't impose these concepts on others. What you did is wrong. You should have done the right thing. That was the right thing for you to do. that starts happening less and less. We stop playing God with other people's lives. I had told you, you should not have done that. See what happened now. If you had only listened to me, all that dialogue goes. It is a different thing when parents are guiding the child, because for the child, the parents are its first teachers, gurus. But so many adults play this game. Right thing to do and wrong thing to do. Another mail had come on the subject of judgment. And it reminded me of what I had read in one of the first books of Rameshji's, which is now unfortunately out of print and unavailable. The question was basically that if I judge someone, what is the harm? Because wouldn't it mean that God is judging someone? If I judge someone based on this teaching, if everything is God's will, then wouldn't it simply mean that God is judging the other person? The amazing game the ego plays. And Rameshji replied to this specific question. I don't know if it was in the late 80s this book came out, perhaps. His reply was, I don't see God judging someone, but a misguided individual judging someone. You see, because if the understanding is total, the judgment will not arise to judge. This process to judge someone will not arise with the understanding that all there is consciousness. And we are all instruments through whom the same consciousness functions. So the judgment is by the individual. But the important point is, it is not the individual's doing. So there's no question of blaming someone for judging, you see. Judgment is based on that person's conditioning and genetics and nature, and a person judges. For someone, the light of understanding may not shine, and it may be a life full of judgments. Judging people, judging situations, judging others, judging oneself, and so on. And yet for someone else, a ray of light may shine. What is this judgment? Where does it come from? What is it based on? Why is this compulsive judgment happening? What does it mean? And that is the start of the spiritual journey. Have I judged my family? Have I judged myself? And then, with this beautiful understanding, one finds that this whole issue of judgment is like a house of cards. It is hollow. And one finds, when one judges less and less, one is more and more at peace. It is the judgment that is creating the psychological suffering. Absence of judgment means peace of mind. Does this mean a sage will not judge? Let's look at it closely. Does it mean that the sage will not judge? Not necessarily, because a situation may arise where a judgment needs to be made, but that judgment will be an impersonal judgment. This is not a play of words. Let's take a situation. Let's say the sage is the head of a corporation. And he is reviewing the work of a staff member. The sage has to decide, has to judge the staff member whether the performance is optimum, not optimum, whether the staff member is of benefit to the company, not of benefit to the company, and so on and so forth. So a point of view needs to emerge even for the sage. But what happens is, in this process of evaluation, the sage is not evaluating an individual and blaming the individual or condemning the individual for lack of performance, let's say. So the judgment is an impersonal judgment, because the sage knows that this person has been gifted with attributes. Some are suiting the company, some may not be. I should bring it to his knowledge to see if there's a change in the output. And then the matter rests there. The sage is not targeting the individual staff member, which is what we do with people. So sometimes the judgment has to take place. Which way do we go? Do we continue our relationship with the staff member, or do we feel it's in the best interest of the organization not to? So therefore, as Rameshji would say, judgment can happen. But for the sage, there is no me judging. There is an impersonal judgment happening. That is why I keep saying that this teaching removes the sting of doership in relationships. Even if one relationship is healed in one's life, when you look at the relationship objectively and you accept that no matter how I've, in my mind, condemned this person for the way he or she is, I truly now understand that this person's life as a child, as an adolescent, I don't know what transpired. I don't know all the factors which shaped this person's thinking. I don't know where all this comes from. And truly, I see them, these people, as being an equal expression of the divine like I am. Even if one relationship gets healed like this, all relationships get transformed, because that feeling is within. It is not on individual people, objects in our life. That feeling is within. If anger arises, the anger is within. It may appear that somebody provoked me and anger has arisen, but the anger is inside. It has really nothing to do with the other. It was waiting to come up. Similarly, judgments have nothing to do with the other. All the judgments are inside. The sun does not judge. Whom should I shine my light on more? And on whom should it be less? But we tend to do that. More attention to our loved ones, to those who make us feel important and good, and less attention to others. That is the me. If one was to sit right now as the pure light of awareness, which is what we are right now, whoever came in front of us would be seen in the same light. But that resting as pure awareness has got converted to me and my story sitting in this chair. And the story of separation has begun. Preferences has begun. Judgments has begun. But resting as being, human being, is what Joel Goldsmith said it in the most beautiful words. Consciousness blesses all that it sees and rests upon. It becomes a blessing. Whatever comes, when one rests more and more in being, that is what happens. Everyone is blessed by the presence. Capital P. That is the sacredness of the moment when two people come together. Someone called me the other day, a friend, and said, I'm really enjoying your talks. But frankly, I find your long pauses quite boring. So can you please stop these long pauses? So I said, if you find them boring, just forward it on YouTube or wherever you're watching. He said, no, but I like watching them live. So I said, it is not a deliberate pause. When something doesn't come, there's a pause. When the next thing comes, the pause ends. But he said, no, you please try not to have these pauses. I said, that would be too much doership. It reminds me of this story, you see. There was a priest or a minister who was giving a sermon in the church, which went on and on and on and on, maybe 2 hours or something. And at the end of the sermon, the minister announced that there's just little more time left, but at the end, there will be a meeting of the board. So those who are connected with the church, please stay. And then he went on and on. And at the end of the sermon, the minister was waiting there and one stranger came up to him and he didn't recognize him. So he said, what are you doing here? This is a meeting of the board. And the stranger said, yes, I wanted to see if there was anyone more bored than me in this sermon. the thinking mind gets bored. That is why Maharaj would say it is such a paradox. We love our being, and yet we find our being unbearable, and therefore we end up doing things to keep ourselves busy. That is the paradox. We love to be. Everyone loves to be. It's a natural setting. And yet, we find it unbearable. Just to be, we find boring. That is the natural paradox. All right. If there's anyone who would like to ask a question or share anything, they are most welcome to do that now. I might have pressed some wrong button here.
Thank you, Gautam.
Yes, Holger. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for your boring satsang. I pretty early discovered in life that boredom is a healthy state of mind.
Yes.
And thank you for mentioning Joel Goldsmith. I spent lots of time listening to him and reading him.
Mm-hmm. Yes, beautiful works, beautiful.
Yes, but I just used him kind of as a painkiller. I mean, I didn't really know how to listen or what not to do.
Right. Okay.
And interesting, right now, the last few days, I experience a lot of peace. And then I remember why I started with all of this seeking. I always wanted to understand something, or I wanted to know something. And then being confronted with so much peace, there's kind of a disappointment on one level and lots of joy. I mean, it's quite interesting.
That's a nice phrase you use, being confronted with peace. It's a good one. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, Sadhana.
Yeah.
Please describe to me the feeling of I am-ness apart from the standard way of describing the first thing in the morning.
I don't think a description is needed because we all know we are, right?
Confusion is distinction between a feeling of the body. We assume we are the body. That is the natural reaction. And that is what we know as far as I am concerned.
Yes.
There may be different stages of other people I'm not aware of.
Yes.
How do I get beyond that, if at all needed?
If someone asked you, and this is a cliche, if someone asked you, are you a man? You would say, of course I am, because you know it. You don't need to prove it. You don't even need to prove it to yourself. Right? So there's no question of trying to know something that you already are. For example, which is the most common example my teacher used, if your memory was wiped out right now, your complete memory, I pushed a button and your complete memory was wiped out. You don't even remember your name. Yet, you not only exist, but you know you exist. Imagine you're sitting in a chair and you have no memory at all, but you still exist. The I am is there. There is no me superimposed over the I am, saying, I am so and so. This is my family. This is my house. But the I am is there. There's no question of the body as well.
The Understood. Child,
the baby is in the crib. It's pure awareness. The baby does not think I am aware. It is pure being. Yes.
As a concept and an intellectual state, one can conceptually think, conceptually, if I may say, use, realize that state. I agree with you entirely. It is a motionless state of consciousness. Conceptual, agree, no denying. Practically is my problem.
But that is the problem itself. To want to know it practically is the problem.
You're right. I think you are right. If that
is the me thing, which wants to make this practical, you see.
Absolutely correct.
The problem is not the I am, it is the me. That me has to vacate the position.
If one is clear that that question itself is a movement in the consciousness, and yes, that question itself is the problem, is that a correct and a deep understanding of the teachings?
Absolutely.
So what you're saying is witness, questions, answers, they are at the same level as anything else. Witness. That's what you're saying.
You see, because of two things, both questions and answers are polaric opposites of each other in this realm of duality. But in witnessing, they cancel each other out. And witnessing is not something that you as a me can do. Witnessing is happening all the time.
Yes.
But what happens is that the me tries to witness and makes a practice out of it. Witnessing is happening all the time.
Do we need to get into the polaric theory because then you get into matter, antimatter and all that? Do we need to do that?
Absolutely, we don't need it at all. But some of us can't help getting into it.
Gautam, another quick question. Bhagwan always says consciousness is a result or a consequence of five elements.
Yes.
At the same time, he says world is an illusion.
Yes.
Now, how did the five elements come into the picture as an existence? And at the same time, Bhagwan Maharaj says that it is an illusion. At the same time, he says your consciousness rests on an illusion. I mean, we are building walls of illusion or stories of illusion.
Yes, which is what the me is doing. The five elements are the principles of creation.
The creation, it's an illusion. So where is the question of those five elements coming as a creation? It is a part of the illusion. Why are Maharaj complicating our life?
But what does that mean? That the manifestation, the illusion, is an appearance of consciousness within consciousness. It is the illusion is not separate from consciousness. You see, because if consciousness is the source and consciousness is all there is, it is an illusion because it is an appearance within consciousness itself.
Agreed, absolutely.
It is the individual which gets lost in a forest of concepts and starts trying to make sense of this.
So five elements are an illusion to simplify explanation of a concept.
The five elements would not exist, so to speak, if there was no me inquiring about the five elements.
So it is an illusion?
Everything is an appearance within consciousness. In that sense, what is illusion? What is Maya? What is Maya? What is the divine hypnosis? The divine hypnosis is this appearance of separation. Everything appears separate from me. Whereas what Bhagwan is trying to say, and he certainly doesn't need my help, is that it is the individual, the me, which is the primary illusion. You see, if the me collapses, what is left is pure being. You see?
Gautam, just to be a little insistent, I made that way, so
forgive me. I'm very happy to hear your questions because it shows that there's been a lot of thought given to this subject.
Yes, only thought, very little insight. And that is the problem with the thinking, and you will say that's a thinking mind. Absolutely right. So coming back, so whenever I read the statement of Maharaj that consciousness raids on the five elements, can I skip that part and say, all right, consciousness is a movement of awareness and leave it at that rather than try to understand the concept of five elements? Is that okay?
I think you should leave anything and everything that is not giving you peace of mind. Five elements or 10 elements, just forget it. Your criteria should be whatever I am trying to understand. What is the measure? The only measure, as Bhagwan himself has said, is by the degree of peace that you feel. So if a concept is troubling you because you are not able to understand it, not understanding it is taking one away from peace. Because
it makes me feel guilty. It makes me feel that I will miss a point if I don't understand this concept.
Absolutely.
Of course, you will say now, witness that also.
No, you're absolutely, that's most beautifully said, because that is how the me operates. Okay. That is how the me operates.
So why don't you give me a simple answer that yes, treat it as a concept and let go and that's, keep on?
No, I'm saying forget even that. Okay. Whatever you are studying or reading or contemplating on, let the criteria and measure be only one. How is it connected to my peace of mind? So rather than getting lost in understanding the five elements and this and that, let it go. If possible,
by your simple explanation, I'll have to just leave alone my library and just sit alone and keep just what see what's happening.
Yes, but the library plays its role and played its role.
Yeah, okay. Right.
Library cannot be discounted. When you are traveling on a journey to the source, for example, steps have to be taken. What happens when we read other people's experiences and about their lives, we gain insights. That is the beauty of reading. But what could happen is that the reading stays as reading with no direct impact on my peace of mind. Now the time comes whenever that is destined, that one feels, okay, I've read enough. I could read more if I felt like, but let me sit and look back at my life, my relationships. How much at peace am I at? Am I at peace with what happens to me, with people in my life, with situations in my life? Let that become the sadhana. Let that become the practice. That is called living the teaching.
Okay, I will not ask any further questions. Let other people ask. If they don't ask, I'll ask.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Okay.
Yes, can I
Namaste, Gautam ji.
Namaste.
I should say this Sunday become a temple for me, as you have given one line, the church. Every Sunday you went to church to your Guruji. Mm-hmm. And this is the temple for me because I have observed two times. Like last Sunday, I was in some situation, the mind was into fights and I was not able to come out. And I just put it on this platform and I got all the answers. Today also it happened. I just came out from the out cycling karke and I said, oh, this is going to start. And again, I was not able to focus. But when I start focusing, all the answers were getting what the fight was going on. So I just, two lines came, Guru Mat Pita, Guru Bandhu Sakha. Only two lines and I was dying to connect to that consciousness. And every Sunday I feel the presence of that pure consciousness. And you make my life more simpler because I read so many things. But when I hear few lines, like just absence of me and my story, being in presence, everything is sorted out so easily, so purely, nothing else. You don't want to do anything, jap or meditation, because I am doing all this stuff just to get connected with that pure consciousness and get stability and equilibrium in my life so I can focus on around me and my people and give love. But when I get disconnected, I get disturbed. So this teaching bring me closer and closer to my source, to myself. I'm really thankful to you.
Most welcome. And the beauty is that this teaching does not really depend on Sundays because the teaching is within. At the end of the day, the Sadhguru is within, the teaching is within. And maybe just like an alarm bell on Sunday mornings, it rings the alarm, I'm here. But it is something one is always ever immersed in, you see. One is always ever immersed in it. That is the beauty. That is, in fact, you know, when my teacher passed away, someone asked me that, were you really shattered? I mean, were you shaken up and shattered and depressed for some time? And my answer was no. My answer was that the teaching is so alive. And my teacher was not one who acted like a crutch, you see. Like you could not go and lean on his shoulder and cry about your troubles and your problems. And he would say, don't worry, it'll be all right. He was none of that. He would say, we'll see what happens. Or he would say, whatever happens is God's will, and give a nice smile like a grandfather. You know, whatever happens is God's will. So when he passed away, the teaching was so alive that there was no room for missing the Sunday talks. I yet miss it as a routine of going to see him, having the darshan and being in the space of satsang. Of course, that is missed. But the teaching is throbbing and pulsating and alive every moment, you see. It does not leave one. So every day becomes a Sunday.
Bless me, the teaching becomes within me.
Consciousness blesses everything. You see, the only thing is we have to be open to the grace. Being open to receive, being open to the grace is all that is required as such. Because the blessings are always there. Okay? Thank you. That's very sweet of you.
Thank you.
Yes, Dipti.
Hi, Gautamji. Thanks for all your podcasts and videos. I've been following you for a long time now. This week, this question about judgment was already running in my mind. I was thinking, I was trying how to stop myself from actually, it has been conditioned like that. I'm just aware of it and I'm just trying to actually stop it. So there is one question that came into my mind. So based on all the past experiences and based on because you have to lead your life on, sometimes you have to handle things on your own. So how is it practically possible to stop judging? You have to judge, otherwise people walk all over you, and sometimes you are also considered to be naive. And this is like in one extreme you feel like, okay, you should stop judging. In the other extreme, you feel like, you know, you cannot do it. It's practically not possible. So is it, can you explain me in a better way so that I understand how can I apply this into my life?
But we just discussed that where I gave an example of the sage practicing impersonal judgment. You see, once you are clear that you are not judging an individual, that he is like that or she is like that, what happens is you may still have to make a judgment, but because you are no longer blaming someone for being a certain way, the judgment becomes impersonal. If you find that my judgment is still based on what I like and what I don't like about a person, and I blame them for being the way they are, that is the judgment of the me. So this is something which will also give you a sense of how deep the teaching has gone. If someone does something that you don't like, okay, because the teaching doesn't say like everything, that's not practical. If someone does something you don't like or says something you don't like, okay, if you have the total acceptance that this person, first of all, is entitled to their point of view, I cannot control another's point of view. They are entitled to it. Their judgment is based on their thought processes, their genetics, their condition. Okay, so there's no fight, there's no this personal fight already taking place because you accept that this person is a manifestation of the way God has wanted this person to be. Now, you may have a different point of view. You may not like what is being said, and you express your point of view. You see, in this exchange, what has happened is that this old dynamic of blame and condemnation has dropped away. That is no longer functioning. If you feel that is still functioning, then that means the teaching has perhaps just come to a certain intellectual understanding. But if you find that now I, in a very clear light, see that people are the way they are, and I must say something because I don't like this, absolutely valid. But that sting of personal doership has gone from the equation. You see that finger pointing which we used to do, when that finger pointing stops, it does not mean we don't react and we sit back as zombies. But it means we are no longer targeting individuals. So if we don't like what someone does, with this teaching, what happens is that the next day you may just find yourself giving a hug to this person because you're living more spontaneously. You are not carrying this load of this person did this and that person did that. All that has gone from your shoulders. That is what happens.
Okay.
I hope makes that sense. Has made sense at some level.
That makes sense. Maybe I should start applying, then I'll know better.
It will happen. Let it happen. It happens on its own. Okay. Let the teaching do its job.
Thank you.
Okay. Yes, Santosh. Have I clicked on the wrong button? I'm using a new computer, so please allow these kind of funny things happening. Sorry, Santosh, have I called you up by mistake or?
No. Okay. I had a question.
I see.
Good morning. Okay. I just want to ask something about multitasking. Nowadays, I see, a lot of people, even I also do a lot of multitasking in the sense I am reading something and simultaneously I watch video also. While studying, I watch video, I listen to music as well. Even I found some people driving and at the simultaneously they talk on the mobile also. So how do you see all these things, doing a lot of things at a time? Is it related to the peace of mind or the consciousness? I just want to have your view on this, please.
You see, Santosh, different people are built differently. Now, for example, some people I know, when they work, they love listening to music and they feel the work is giving better output. Now, me, I can only do one thing at a time. I'm built that way. So if I'm working, I can't listen to music. That is the way I'm built. And other people are genetically built to be very comfortable with multitasking. It does not mean they are not at peace or anything like that. You see, the whole point is, if one is totally engaged in the working mind mode, and if with multitasking, your task is not compromised, you don't feel, oh, because I'm multitasking, I'm watering down or diluting my effectiveness, because then obviously multitasking is not working. But if one finds that multitasking enables me to be rooted in the moment and give my best while I'm, you know, listening to music and playing the stock market. So be it. That is the way one is designed. I have a friend who's a master multitasker. He can do 5 things at the same time, which my head starts spinning when I see him do that. He is built that way. The whole point is, when one is engaged in the working mind, being engaged in the working mind is, in a sense, the same as witnessing. What I mean is, when the working mind is engaged, the thinking mind is not playing havoc.
Okay.
So working is meditation in that sense, because one is engaged. Now, whether that engagement stays optimum with multitasking, it surely can for some people. For some people, it can't. They find their focus going haywire. So when the attention is no longer fixed in the moment, that is a beautiful measure to know whether one is suffering the multitasking. I hope that has answered your question.
Yes. Thank you.
Great. Sadhana's hand is still up. Is there one more question, or is that just my mistake? What is your name? I mean, I presume Sadhana is not your name.
No, he's my husband, Ashok Patni.
Ashok Patni, my name Ashok. Is Ashok.
Yes, Ashok.
Now, you constantly use the word that sage is judging, but not personally.
Yes. If required, means judgment can arise if there's a need for it.
So that is the practical point of view, and quite rightly so. But isn't the basic truth is, even to a sage, the judgment has occurred in his consciousness.
Yes. Right. And but because there's no sense of personal doership, the judgment has not become a story of the sage judging someone as an individual.
Just arguing, even if it does become a story in the sage's consciousness, and of course, being a sage, he will be aware of that story coming.
No.
Would that be a correct situation or no? Yes, please.
For the sage, this will not arise. It is not that personal judging will arise in a sage and that will be witnessed. For the sage, personal judgment is not possible. And by sage, what I mean is a man at peace.
Right.
And understanding. So that is the end of the story of personal judging. It is not that it will arise and it will be witnessed. No.
Okay.
It's a very good question you have asked, and it is a very big distinction here, because if it was to arise for the sage and it is witnessed, then there is no difference between the sage and the ordinary man.
Absolutely correct. Absolutely correct.
Sage is resting in peace.
Right. He's at a higher level.
The whole process, you know, has got cut for the sage.
Right.
The process that the thinking mind of the ordinary person goes through has got cut. The involvement has got cut. Therefore, the sage is always resting in peace.
Right. If the story was to occur to a very ordinary person like me, then I would witness it.
Yes.
And without a thought comes and it goes, thought comes. Only difference between me and sage are that I have multiple thoughts. Sage has probably one or two thoughts, maybe. Therefore, what is the difference? I mean, he's witnessing one thought. I'm witnessing 100 thoughts. But I'm not attached to any thought. Sage is unfortunate to have one thought. I'm just joking, please.
No.
But he, so where is the problem? Why is he a sage and I'm not a sage?
The difference is because the ordinary person has got involved in the thought and gone through the process of thinking and built a story. For the sage, the involvement in the thought does not happen. But what the ordinary person does is builds this huge monument of a story around a thought and projects it into the future or into the dead past or into blame, condemnation, malice, hatred, envy, and so on. So that is what does not happen for the sage. It is the end of this involvement in the thought.
Multiple thoughts do not mean involvement. It could be a bird. It could be Gotham's smile. It could be a building, totally unconnected,
yes.
Not a story.
Yes.
Then what is the difference between sage and me?
It is the difference of thought and thinking. Thoughts are never the problem. The extension of the thought in the duration of time, the involvement of the thinking mind in the thinking which it wraps a thought with more and more gift wrapping, wrapping after wrapping after wrapping after wrapping.
But the instance I gave you where two thoughts are just witnessed, they are not a story of each other, but many in number compared to thought, few in number, what is the difference?
There is a big difference because what you are thinking is witnessing is not witnessing. Judgment cannot arise in witnessing.
That is what I'm saying. There is no judgment. There's a bird, there's a building, there is Gautam's smile.
Yes.
These are flashes occurring in my consciousness. There is no judgment.
Yes.
One cinema, one screen after another.
Yes.
Only difference is sage has few screens. I have many screens going per second.
Yes.
But I am not involved in any one of them. I am witnessing. Where is the problem?
There is no problem. But supposing the ordinary person sees a bird come to the window and says, oh my God, I don't want a crow coming to my window. I wanted a nice, beautiful parrot coming. Now I'll wait for the parrot to come. I wish this crow goes away. And so on and so forth, starts building a whole story around what you...
Assume that does not happen. Assume that does not happen. That is my basic assumption.
Then there is no difference. If the ordinary person finds that they are not involved in the duration of horizontal time, then they are living the life of a sage. But one cannot say that, supposing I'm judging someone, and the judgment is as before, and I'm witnessing the judgment, I am a sage. That does not happen.
That you explained very well. That is a matter of level.
Yes. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, my pleasure.
Okay.
Yes, Saritra. I think we can make this the last one.
Hi, Gautam. So I don't have any question. Do you hear me?
Yes, yes.
So, there is this song, Jab Koi Baat Bigad Jaye, and in that song, there is the lyrics, Na Koi Hai, Na Koi Tha, Zindagi Mein Tumhare Siva. Meaning, neither there is anyone, nor there was anyone, except you. And I have been fantasizing about this, and... it's kind of meditative, I should say. The song is not at all about this. It's a romantic song, but yeah.
So are you going to do this for us or what?
Oh, no. I just say.
Actually, that is called living the life spiritually. If one really lives this, that there's no you, me, he, and she, but we are all instruments through whom the same consciousness functions. That is true living. That is true living. You see where this whole realm of separation starts dissolving. And one sees the one divine force behind everything. That is when the vision starts changing from the two eyes, the two physical eyes, to the eye of singularity, the third eye. One sees the totality of it all. One sees how everything is equally valid and equally invalid. And one sees the hand of the one divine in this play of life, in what we label as good times, bad times, good people, not so good people. When one sees with this vision, where these labels of opposites start dissolving into one, that is the life spiritual. Okay.
Yes, thank you. Thank you.
Okay. I think we can just sit in silence for a few minutes. I'll just change the view so I can see all of you. How does that happen? View.